Gay marriage is in limbo. Is it necessary? Tony Bennett fined. Was it enough? The call for tougher gun penalties, a state lawmaker headed to Afghanistan, and questions about the state surplus. That, plus the governor's trip to England and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending July 11, 2014.
Programming is made possible by Ice Miller. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
AT&T, working to enhance connectivity in Indiana by investing in communication networks. Dedicated to helping Hoosier businesses grow and consumers succeed both at home and at work. AT&T. Rethink possible.
This week, the governor ruled that Indiana state government won't recognize same-sex marriages conducted here in June. The news came in a memo written by General Counsel Mark Ahern sent to state agency heads. It says that Indiana's ban on gay marriage is in full force and agencies should act as if the June 25th order striking it down had not been issued. On the 25th, 26th, and 27th of June, hundreds of couples purchased marriage licenses and took vows entering into unions that will be recognized by the federal government. The governor, however, says he is just complying with the law.
Indiana's marriage law remains intact. The state of Indiana must operate in a manner consistent with the laws of Indiana.
But the hundreds of marriages that took place were legal at the time. Why not recognize them?
In consultation with our general counsel, we believe a proper reading of the Court of Appeals decision stays the impact of the initial federal court's decision.
Did Mike Pence do the right thing? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel, Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, John Schwanes, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. I'm Wish TV State House reporter Jim Shella. Ann Delaney, can the governor go against legal advice?
Yeah, of course he can. And of course he can also shape that legal advice. I said last week that he could be a profile in courage and recognize all those marriages. I mean, obviously when the stay was issued by the Seventh Circuit, they made an exception for the one terminally ill lady.
Sandler and Nikki Kwasny.
Right. And not to take anything away from that. I mean, obviously that's a crucial situation. But everybody else in this situation that was married, those hundreds of people, those hundreds of couples that were married legally in Indiana, are in the same kind of limbo. And he could have just stood up and said, we're going to recognize those, and then we'll see what happens with the Seventh Circuit. And he didn't. He's just playing to the Republican right wing for his presidential campaign.
But he didn't. In all of his commentary, he referred only to legal arguments. I mean, can he play to the right wing?
He made a legal decision, not a unilateral policy decision. Every step of the way, he said, follow the court order. All three times he's done that. And in this case, because the stay was only pulled on the one marriage case and not on all the others, he's following the law again. And those will be decided, as we talked about in the show last week. They're going to be in limbo. And they're going to be decided eventually by the courts over the next year or year and a half or whatever it's going to take for this whole process to run through the court system. So he did what he thought was right legally instead of making a unilateral policy decision. And he's been consistent all three times with his order to how state government should handle this and follow the law.
And all three times they've issued an internal memo. Did this deserve something of a public announcement from the governor's office?
I can understand why he would not have a big event. I mean, clearly the memo was released from his chief counsel initially, and then there was the follow-up discussion that you highlighted in the introduction. I mean, it's not something he's necessarily wants to go out and have a balloon drop over. But at the same time, it seems to me that this is politically for him the smartest move. Now, I'm not saying whether I agree with it or not, but politically it's probably the smartest move and also the path of least resistance. And in part, it mirrors what we've seen other governors do across the country. He would have been pretty much an outlier, I think, among governors had he made a different decision. And given that if he has any aspirations for running for president, and we know what the primary season is like in Republican primaries, I'm not sure that would have been a viable decision.
So the ACLU of Indiana today sent a letter to Attorney General Eric Holder asking him to make a federal declaration regarding Indiana marriages. The assumption is that the federal government will recognize them, but this sounds like the precursor to more legal action.
Well, there's definitely going to be more legal action because the courts still have to rule on the appeal that's been brought by the state of Indiana on the original ruling by the district court judge. So, you know, there's going to be more legal action. There may be more lawsuits. But I would say this about the governor's decision. He indeed is following his precedent set with this particular case, and so he can make that legal argument. But he did, in another case, make a policy decision, Mike, when it comes to same-sex marriage. Last year, when the Defense of Marriage Act was struck down by the Supreme Court, or parts of it were, the state had a choice. It could make a very simple sheet to allow people to file their state taxes in line with their federal taxes. And instead, the state chose not to do that, so that it's much more difficult for same-sex couples who have the federal recognition to file their state taxes. They essentially end up filing three tax returns in order to do the two. And so I would argue that that's a policy decision that the governor's administration made that is not consistent with the argument that's being made now.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think they're hiding behind the legal argument that he had crafted just to give him that kind of a shield. And he didn't do what was right. And he's still discriminating against those couples and same-sex marriages. But I think the Seventh Circuit will eventually strike it down.
Moving on, former state school superintendent Tony Bennett will pay a $5,000 fine for violating the state ethics code. Bennett agreed to a settlement that was approved by the State Ethics Commission this week. He admitted to using state government computers for political activity. An investigation by the state inspector general found, however, that Bennett did not change the state's A to F grading system to benefit a political contributor. Here is Bennett's attorney, Larry Mackey.
Especially as a superintendent of schools, it's all about modeling good behavior. And if there's anybody who ought to stand up and say, whatever the rules are, I need to follow them, it's somebody like the superintendent.
Mike McDaniel, should Bennett have made an appearance at that hearing?
I don't know that it was necessary for him to make an appearance at the hearing.
I find it interesting that Larry Mackey said that as superintendent he should stand up and acknowledge this. And
well,
he had the opportunity there. And,
well, they did in the process. And this is a bipartisan commission. The chairman of this commission was appointed by Governor Kernan. And so I don't think anybody can take a look at the ruling that they made and said that this was, you know, some kind of a political decision. It wasn't. The job was a $60,000 a year job, and they fined him $5,000, which in the big scheme of things is reasonable, I think. Nobody worked harder for children in the state than did Tony Bennett, but he wasn't the smartest guy politically by doing some stuff they did with running computer operation out of that office. I mean, clearly that was the wrong thing to do, and Mackey was right to say that.
Well, not only did he pay the fine, he also lost a job in Florida and has paid a lot of legal fees. Did he get punished severely enough?
For what he did, he probably did, okay? But having said that, the attitude that's there, it really troubles me. The idea that all you would have to do is have a written policy permitting this and it's okay? I mean, you can't legislate judgment.
That's what the inspector general said.
Right, and that's ridiculous.
They said as a state office holder, he could do that. State employees cannot.
Oh, come on. Come on. It's state equipment, okay? It is ridiculous that you could say you could write a policy, and that shows some of the pervasive problems with this administration, whether it's the Department of Transportation or the IURC or the Economic Development or the Indiana House of Representatives. They do things that when you look at that, you know it's corrupt. You know it's corrupt. And they all say, well, if, you know, it meets the letter of the law, or if you'd just written it down, you know, it would be okay. It is bad judgment, it's corruption, and it should not occur.
Anybody who's run for public office at that level knows that it's very difficult to draw that line very clearly on a day-to-day basis on what you're doing. If you're taking a state car as a public official to an event, where you're getting some political benefit from that event, is that crossing that line? I mean, it's very murky on a day-to-day basis on how you deal with that stuff.
Mike, it's not murky.
It is.
Put a donor list on a state committee.
No, no, no.
I don't care.
I said that.
Okay. I don't care about a schedule.
I'm talking about the other stuff.
I understand about the schedule.
And, boy, the law's written that where you have to be careful about how you do that.
You have to have judgment.
I agree with that. But it's hard.
The law, whether it's hard or not, it should be done because the public is going to lose trust and maybe already has lost trust in the political process, Mike. They need to do the right thing, which is to legislate this clearly so that you don't have a question like you just talked about, because until you do, you're going to have people making bad choices, and faith in the system will be even lower than it is. We have to make that law change, and they ought to have courage to do it.
Write that up the way you're talking
some
about.
You
can address some of the problems that have been brought to light.
And some of the instances that have been brought to light in this case, if I understand it, are more egregious than just inadvertent schedule items showing up in an Outlook folder or something like that. You have allegedly Tony Bennett telling staff members to research Glenda Ritz's speech to see if there are errors in it politically. That's problematic. Or talking about obtaining campaign finance reports, again, by state employees on state time. I've written a lot about ghost employment over the years. In some instances, the things that were accusations were far less serious than this, and in other cases, far more serious. But I'll tell you, this seems to be a relatively minor penalty. Let's put it this way. A lot of people have gotten much harsher punishments for much less.
And maybe convictions. It sounds like this event is over.
You could make a case that, you know, that the Ethics Commission and the Ombudsman have swept a lot of this under the rug.
They did refer it to the prosecutor, and they've been told that the prosecutor is not going to pursue it.
That's fine. But how long ago was this? And we're just now getting to the resolution.
It did take a while.
Everything there takes forever.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question is, was Tony Bennett's punishment severe enough? Your choices are A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question was, if invited, would you attend the wedding of a same-sex couple? 79% said yes. 18% said no. 3% said it depends on my schedule. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Indiana is mourning the deaths of three law enforcement officers this week. Tipton County Deputy Jacob Calvin, Gary Policeman Jeffrey Westerfield, and IMPD Officer Perry Wren all died in the line of duty. The shooting of Wren has city leaders calling for tougher gun penalties. Mayor Greg Ballard.
Frankly, I'm just not going to accept the fact that we're going to continue to allow the police to rearrest these people over and over again and then wonder why.
We owe it to his family to honor him tonight, to keep them and IMPD in prayers. But we all have to roll up our sleeves and send a message to those people who continue to wreak carnage and harm in our community, that you are not, and that's no longer IMPD is not satisfied, that you as a community are not satisfied.
Police Chief Rick Height there, John Ketzenberger. Will this lead to changes in the criminal code?
I hope so. When we've talked about, you know, reform of sentencing, we talked about how nonviolent criminals and changing the way they're sentenced and handled in the system makes some sense. But when you're talking about people with a history of violence and you're talking about using a destructive weapon with so much impunity, I think that the officials are right about this when it comes to gun crimes and the sentences for people who have had previous records in that regard. But I also hope it leads to a broader sense of change so that it goes from the bottom up and people become more involved in the community and can make big changes like improving the education, improving the poverty rate, and improving the opportunities for people so they don't see crime as a viable lifestyle.
In the case of Officer Wren, the man accused of shooting him, Major Davis Jr., had only a misdemeanor and apparently had legal possession of a gun, but it was an AK-47. Is this an argument? I'm interested that these guys are talking about penalties, but this is an argument for an assault weapons ban, isn't it?
Well, I think you will. There has been a groundswell of support for that kind of restriction this week. Now, whether a municipality or state can do that unilaterally is very much in question, given some of the decisions in recent years that the U.S. Supreme
Court probably a federal case.
Has made. Where I think, and for that reason, there will be people who try, don't get me wrong, but I think the more likely avenue here is something that Senator Jim Merritt, Indianapolis, and others have advocated, not maybe to the degree that he had, but last year and this year, apparently he's interested in tacking on as much as 20 years. And that, I think he recognizes
that. Actually, you can do that now. You can
yeah,
do that
now.
You
can
now.
Do it right
well,
now.
Not, well, do
part
it.
Part
of the problem, mandatory.
Does that do?
This is
part of the problem is prosecutors haven't been taking advantage
Well, and the
of that,
issue right? here, it seems to me, that what yeah. that gives people who have are very concerned about yeah. their Second Amendment credentials, you know, only criminals will have guns
right.
if you do away with yeah. the ability to
obtain
guns.
Except he had the gun legally.
I'm simply saying, but then once you commit the crime, a crime with a gun, I think there even first yeah. Second Amendment advocates yeah. can
How
say,
does that
well,
stop
but
it? It
doesn't
stop it.
I'm saying what's more likely.
Everybody's
for a
more willing to talk
crackdown.
About this now, but it doesn't sound like there's much of a consensus out there.
Well, I think this will lead to change. I think it will lead to change, especially in the Indian Journal Assembly. But John's right. This is a bigger problem now. I mean, you look at what happened in Chicago with 82 shootings and 11 deaths over the July 4th weekend. I mean, this is not just here. I mean, there's other parts of the country where
it's the same gun problem.
Well, it is the same gun problem, and that is a federal gun problem. And they've got to do something about assault weapons. We had a situation in this country, I forget how long ago it was, but it was mayors, I think, that came together and tried to do something with this. And seriously, I mean, this is just crazy. And I think we'll lead to a lot of changes. I do think the mandatory sentences does make a difference. And when the word gets out that, you know, you do anything with a gun, it's an extra 20 years, and that makes a difference to people. And I think Merritt's right to do that.
I don't think it makes much difference. I don't think when you have young kids with no judgment and assault weapons, that they sit there and think what will happen if they do something wrong and they get arrested and they get prosecuted.
This weapon was purchased by his mother.
It was purchased by his mother, was purchased legally, and that is absolutely reprehensible. We should not have assault weapons available. We shouldn't have armor-piercing bullets available. We shouldn't have magazines that cover that can carry so much yeah. ammunition in them. And part of the problem is, in Indiana, we used to have local ordinances on this, and the state legislature, as it takes all the power away from local government, took that away as well.
Well, it's not
the rules
state.
Here, the rules in Indianapolis are not the same as the rules in LaGrange County, and shouldn't be. The concerns are different, but we have got to get the consensus. Putting extra time on somebody you're already going to lock up may make you feel good.
Just blame the Indiana Assembly. The U.S. Supreme Court has been party to that as well.
I understand that. The Republican yeah. U.S. Supreme Court's been a party to it, too. But part of it is, it seems to me, adding sentences so you have good time on that is right, okay? But it isn't the solution.
Moving on. An Indiana state senator is going on active duty in the Navy, but plans to keep his seat in the General Assembly. Republican Jim Banks of Columbia City announced this week that he will be sent to Afghanistan in September and will miss the 2015 session of the legislature. He wants his wife, Amanda, to take over his role in the state Senate while he's away. A 1971 state law that has never been used before makes that possible.
Amanda and I and our three daughters are learning firsthand about the sacrifice that so many thousands of families have made before us, and gaining a new appreciation for those who have served.
We didn't think it was right that a member of the legislature or anywhere else would have to give up their job. They don't have to do that in civilian life. And in fact, we go to great-
Senate President Pro Tem David Long there, John Schwantes, is that all on the up and up?
I mean, technically, it is all on the up and up, Jim. You have somebody who's serving his country, who feels a duty, obligation to serve. He made that clear during his news conference, his announcement. You can't begrudge him that. We can only appreciate and applaud him for doing that. I guess what you're alluding to, if you want me to engage
well,
in more cynical speculation.
We've been calling this nepotism, but
I don't think it's nepotism. I mean, Some people have said the timing, because the announcement came after the deadline had passed for people
he's
to fill.
He's unopposed
for people to fill seats. He says that was all simply a matter of getting his personal affairs in order and making decisions. I don't think you could.
Not his responsibility to come up with an opponent.
Look, we encourage people to serve. We try to make it as a society easy that they can return to their jobs in the civilian sector. I think we probably as a society owe it the same to members of the General Assembly.
Significant fact that if his wife does take over for him, she has to be elected by precinct committeeman in that district.
And that's, other candidates could emerge in that process if they choose to do so. So, I think that the process will work itself out. The law is in the books, and if people don't like the idea, then they can challenge it. I don't think there's anything wrong with the proposal. It's the way it's,
And as a practical matter, I don't think you will get a lot of challenge because the optics would be quite unfortunate, I think.
Is he to be celebrated?
I don't have a problem with it. I mean, you're right. They have to go through the precinct committeeman election, and, I don't think he should be penalized for doing his service, which is what giving up his seat would be. So I don't have a problem with it.
Yeah. It's a feel-good story.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, he's been about service most of his life, and this is the next step. He knew it was coming eventually, and he's going to serve his country, and the process is working, and we'll see where it goes. Like John said, somebody else could get in, and anybody can run at this point, but I'd be surprised if anybody other than his wife doesn't end up in that
spot. Look forward to seeing him back in 16.
Yeah. And when he gets reelected, he'll be in Afghanistan, and he's going to take the oath by Skype.
Which I think is determined by the Supreme Court to be an appropriate way to do it.
Interesting. State Auditor Suzanne Crouch will reveal the size of the state budget surplus next week when she discloses the final numbers for the fiscal year that ended June 30th. Her Democratic opponent made an effort to beat her to the punch this week. Michael Clater says he expects the surplus to be calculated at about $2 billion, but he also said that accurate accounting would show it to be closer to $1 billion. The difference, he said, is in unpaid bills.
If I didn't pay my bills, I'd have a surplus too. And hardworking families in Indiana have to pay their bills, so they don't get the luxury of having a large surplus to tout. I think Chef Pence has been cooking the books.
Mike McDaniel, can Clater turn the surplus into a negative?
I don't think so. I think he's going to have an uphill battle trying to do that. We're the fiscal envy of this country when it comes to how we've handled our finances. A $2 billion surplus is... It's a pretty amazing thing in this day and age. Even if you had a $1 billion surplus, as he's suggesting we have, that's still pretty substantial. But people don't realize that's about what, John, 30 days where the state government running 30 days to have a $2 billion surplus. So even though it's the envy of the country, it's something to be heralded. He's going to have a tough time making that argument.
Well, if you're running for auditor, it's tough to make any arguments.
Well, but I think he's making a good argument. I mean, we're not funding the pensions. We're not paying unemployment compensation. And we're not paying the contract that we had with families that adopted children with special needs. And those are reprehensible. We haven't restored education funding. I mean, it's great that there's a surplus, but it's nowhere near $2 billion. That's clear.
Does he have a point?
Yeah, he has a point. But, I think we have to wait and see what the numbers say before we get too exercised about this. And I think Mike makes another good point is, a $1 billion surplus is still a surplus. And a lot of states are still struggling with what they're trying to do from a deficit perspective. And the other thing I think that people really should look for is a structural surplus. And that's what Clater was getting to. And we'll see what that is. If that's on the very positive side, then he might lose some
political weight. It's tough for him to win this argument, isn't it?
Well, I don't know, but you made the point. Somebody made the point. It's tough to get people to pay attention to the auditor's race, especially when your opponent's the one who is going to be making what, by all accounts, will be the big high-profile announcement. Here we've spent a couple minutes talking about a race we wouldn't have otherwise. So, again, I guess on the politics of it.
I just got us confused with Illinois.
Well, I think he knows what he's talking about.
Finally, the governor is leaving on his third foreign trade mission. He previewed the trip in a FedEx hangar at the airport. Mike Pence is headed to England and the Farnborough Air Show in an effort to build on the growing aerospace industry in Indiana. He plans to meet with more than a dozen companies. Pence will be one of five governors in attendance.
It not only draws these companies, but also in many cases, it draws the chairman and the CEO of those companies into one place, and we're going to be able to have a number of very high-level meetings and begin to build some relationships.
And Delaney, does that sound like business or pleasure?
Oh, it sounds more like pleasure to me. It sounds like another all-expense-paid vacation. Now, fortunately, this time, apparently, he's not using taxpayer money, but I'd like to know what businesses are contributing to it.
Well, he says he was encouraged to go by executives at GE Aviation who are building a big plant at Lafayette.
Okay, are they paying for the trip, too?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
The agenda on this is one of the most aggressive they've had on any trip. It is not paid for with taxpayer dollars. It's smart to do this. You have to have a presence at these kind of events. And he's smart to go there.
At
and
air
it's
shows? Going to pay.
Absolutely.
That's where a lot of the deals are.
Absolutely. That's the biggest
I'm glad he's getting a vacation. He doesn't do anything here anyway. He might as well go.
You're on the wrong side of that one.
That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity or Bright House Networks. I'm Jim Shella of Wish TV. We'll see you again next week.
Programming is made possible by Ice Miller. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
AT&T, working to enhance connectivity in Indiana by investing in communication networks. Dedicated to helping Hoosier businesses grow and consumers succeed both at home and at work. AT&T. Rethink possible.